Order. The first item on our agenda this morning is an informational meeting from a couple of representatives from the Taipei Economic and Cultural Offices in Seattle. Vice Chair Lim?
Yes. You want me to introduce
Please.
Our guests? It's our honorable guest sitting back over there with Dr. Chen. The Director General of Taipei Economic Culture Office in Seattle, and also the Yu Chi. What is your formal title?
Council.
Council,
yes.
Okay, both here. And then they are going to present on information on the Taiwan and the U.S. relationship. So hopefully, they are urging the Congress and the President to have a free trade agreement with the United States of Taiwan. Today is the first public hearing. And with that, I'd like to, can I say welcome?
Please, please do.
I'd like to welcome Mr. Chen, the Honorable the Director of Taipei. He's a good friend of mine, and also I just want to mention last year we had a legislative trade mission. We visited China and Taiwan and Korea. We had a great time last year. Welcome.
Thank you so much. The Honorable Chair Witt and all the members of the Council and all the guests, good morning.
Good morning.
It's my great honor and pleasure to be invited here to talk something regarding to the Taiwan USA to sign a free trade agreement. I'm Robert Chen, the Director General of the Taipei Economic Culture Office in Seattle. This office, just like a Consul General, representing the government from Taiwan. We are here to promote a bilateral relation between Taiwan and the six states in the Northwest area, including Oregon State and Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Alaska. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the free trade agreement between the United States and Taiwan. You can see on the PowerPoint, the topic is strengthening the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. The importance of a free trade agreement between the United States and Taiwan. Next. There are about 6 points. Number one, U.S.-Taiwan economic relations. Then Oregon-Taiwan's economic relations. Number three, the benefit to the U.S. of a TUFTA, TAFTA, Taiwan United States Free Trade Agreement. Number four, the benefit to Oregon State of a TAFTA. Number five, congressional and private sector support on this issue. Number six, Oregon legislature's support is needed. Next. Number one is Taiwan, U.S.-Taiwan's economic relation. From the Taiwan side, in last year, in 2006, Taiwan is number six largest U.S. trading partner, and also the number fifth most important destination for the U.S. agricultural export. Taiwan has invested about 557 million U.S. dollars in the United States economy. From the point of U.S. is Taiwan's number three largest trading partner, only after Japan and mainland China. The U.S. has exported $22 billion U.S. dollars worth of goods to Taiwan. The U.S. has imported about $35 billion U.S. dollars worth of goods from Taiwan. And total U.S. invested in Taiwan is about $15 billion U.S. dollars in the Taiwanese economy. Last year, 2006, the bilateral trade between United States and Taiwan is about $61.2 billion U.S. dollars. next. Talking about the Oregon-Taiwan's economic relations, the Oregon state export to Taiwan last year in 2006 about $855 million. There has $250 million or 33.6% growth in compared with last year, 2005. Taiwan now is the eighth largest trading and export market for Oregon product in the year 2006. Oregon export item to Taiwan, including high-tech, about 40%, machinery, 29%, agriculture product, 22%, including potato, onion, fishery goods, fruits, and other products, about 9%. Next. The benefit to the United States of a top down is number one, in the year 2002, the study by the International Trade Commission, they found that under Taiwan-U.S. trade free trade agreement, there will be about 16% or $3.4 billion expected percent and dollars value by which U.S. export to Taiwan will increase annually because of the method before brought by the FTA. Number one, that will reducing or eliminating the barriers on essentially all the Taiwan-U.S. trade in goods and services, including agricultural products. Number two, streamlining regulatory burdens or bureaucratic red tape. Number three, streamlining procedures for U.S. company to establish business operation in Taiwan. Number four, reducing or eliminating the market barrier for service providers. Number five, establishing a mutual recognition mechanism for efficient testing and certification of electronic and electrical equipment and other products. Number six, enhancing Taiwan's law as a gateway for U.S. product and service to the Asia-Pacific region. Number seven, allowing closer Taiwan-U.S. cooperation, particularly in areas such as high-tech research and development. Number eight, complementing bilateral effort to remove regional and multilateral trade barriers. Number nine, increasing custom cooperation and security measures in containers and express shipping. Next, the benefit to the Oregon state of TAFTA. Number one, Taiwan is a potentially large market for Oregon's focus industry products, such as IT industry, biotechnology, semiconductor, LCDs, and chemicals. FTA allowing tariff rate on the majority of agriculture, fishery, and industrial products dropped to zero will increase export of not only this product, but all of Oregon's export to Taiwan. Two, create opportunities for Oregon business to both cooperate with Taiwanese companies and utilize Taiwan as a gateway to China and other Asian markets. Next. Number five, U.S. congressional and the private sector's support on this issue. Number one, on the February 2006, U.S. Representative Mr. Jim Ramsdale and William Jefferson, we submit a concurrent resolution in supporting a Taiwan-U.S. free trade agreement. Right now, over 100 congressmen has endorsed. Two, in March 2006, Senator Max Merkus and John Keel submit a joint proposal to the Finance Committee in the Senate calling for a timely launch of negotiations on a U.S.-Taiwan free trade agreement. There are about 15 senators has endorsed. September 2006, Senate Majority Leader Mr. Bill Frist signed the resolution supporting an FTA. Next, number four, there are more than 120 submissions in support of U.S.-Taiwan free trade agreement coming from companies, associations, chambers of commerce, local government, and think tanks representing a diverse area of industrial, including manufacturing, technologies, service, and agriculture. Number five, as of the April 2007, there are about 50 different houses and Senate from the United States. They have voiced their support for negotiation of a U.S.-Taiwan free trade agreement. Next. Six, the Oregon legislature's support is needed by passing an Oregon legislature's resolution calling on the U.S. government to expedite the launch of a negotiation on a free trade agreement with Taiwan. Your support is very appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chen. Certainly appreciate your coming all the way here to Salem to make the presentation. And we recognize the importance of bilateral trade between your country and ours, and particularly the importance that this trade has for the state of Oregon. So we certainly appreciate your presence. Questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Dahlem.
Thank you very much for coming today. We're talking about a free trade agreement with Taiwan. Not only tariffs, but does that call for the elimination or reduction of domestic price supports also on goods bound for Taiwan or goods out of Taiwan to the United States? Is that part of a free trade agreement too?
Oh yes, that's for a bilateral mutual benefit. So both countries will enjoy the reduction of tariff and other services too. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank you for having this opportunity to have this the informational meeting. I do appreciate Chair Witt. Anyway, and currently, how many states in United States are supporting this free trade agreement?
I just mentioned there are about 50 different state legislatures from different representative House of Representatives and the Senate. Among the 30 states.
30 states.
Yeah. For example, in my service area, I just mentioned the six states. We have support from the Idaho state also. Yeah. They already passed this year the resolution in supporting Taiwan-U.S. free trade agreement.
Okay. Yeah. Additional
please.
Questions, maybe comment. About 2 weeks ago, U.S. and Korea have a free trade agreement signed already. Of course, it's waiting for the both countries' congressional the approval. But do you think the current FTA agreement with U.S. and Korea will help Taiwan do the same path, or how do you see that?
You know, both the Korea and Taiwan are the most very important trading partner to the United States. We have seen Korea and the U.S. sign this free trade agreement. That's for mutual benefit for Korea and the United States. And it will have some impact to Taiwanese product and service. And because there's a very, you know, Korea and Taiwan, they are same kind of competition in international trade. So if they have this kind of enjoyment of the free trade agreement between Korea and the United States, and Taiwan not, so has some impact to Taiwan's trade with the United States. So that's why we would like to also pursue this kind of free trade agreement between Taiwan and the United States.
Additional questions,
please.
My concern is that the mainland China is a growing and powerful country in the world now. Do you think that they might be opposing the Taiwan-U.S. free trade agreement? What is the hindrance in going into the free trade agreement with U.S. and Taiwan? What seems to be the problem in the future?
I don't think so, because, you know, actually the Taiwanese company has a lot of investment in mainland China. It's about over $100 billion from Taiwan capital invested in mainland China right now. So there are so many different companies, different manufacturers set up in mainland China, but they are owned by Taiwanese business person. So we don't see any big problem in terms of the trade, because the trade is kind of globalization issue. It's for all the trading countries, they can get the benefit among the all the international trade. So I think the mainland China, they will also like to see we have increased the trade volume between Taiwan and the United States. That's because I just mentioned so many companies, they really, although they are located in mainland China, really they are from Taiwan. So they will also get benefits. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back to Oregon. I believe you came last interim and addressed this committee during the interim as well. And your information about the exports is very substantial. But I was also wondering about the import number, as far as what I guess I'm seeing $22 billion that we import from Taiwan. No, that's exports again.
Export.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the amount of imports to the U.S. and what the amount of imports to Oregon are from Taiwan, and what products are those that we import?
Basically, Taiwan export to Oregon State, maybe the IT information industry product, and we have some. IT industry is a major part, because you know, Taiwan is not the number one IT producer country. We have about 70% of the computer mass board production from Taiwan, and also number one DVD, and also the notebook is also the number one producer from Taiwan. So I think most of them are the IT-related products. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Do we have a dollar amount on the dollars worth of money that's or products that are imported to Oregon from Taiwan?
May I add some specifications to representative's question? Actually, we have the total amount.
Mr. Chair, can I ask to identify your name first?
Oh, sorry. Yes. It's Yu Qi Yin from Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Seattle and Council. And also taking care of specifically relations, Taiwan's relations with Oregon State. And so we have currently the total number of Taiwan's exports to U.S. But unfortunately, there is no statistics about the amount export to each state. There's no such statistics either on Taiwan side nor on U.S. side. It's really hard to track those products going to which destination, final destination. However, we have the total amount. So the U.S. imported 35 billion goods in 2006 from Taiwan. And also, I would like to add some points to Representative Vice Chair Lim's question just now about the mainland China's impact or their possible reaction. Actually, Taiwan is now currently have over 100 bilateral trade agreements, but there are individual trade agreements, each tacking on a specific issue. And while FTA is a very comprehensive and deeper trade agreement that goes even beyond the scopes that would cover under a WTO scope. So that is why each economy of WTO member is seeking very actively to sign an FTA with their important trading partners, even though they are all in the WTO. And that is also why Taiwan would like to seek the same competition opportunity with U.S. And as Director General just explained, for example, the Korea and Taiwan has more or less the same industries structure in the economy. And if Korea FTA take action, that the goods and services will, most of the tariff would drop to zero and barriers will be removed. And in that way, Taiwan wouldn't have a equal competition base with Korea. And actually, that would not beneficial to U.S. customers either. So that is why we are seeking very actively to have this opportunity to compete equally with other trading partners within the U.S. market. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pelham?
Yes, in my part of the state of Oregon, our factories are usually cattle ranches. And our product is beef on the hoof, beef in the box, wheat, and some tree fruit. We do an excellent trade in wheat. We move a lot of wheat. We also move cherries fresh to Taiwan, which is quite an accomplishment. But I'm really concerned about beef. We seem to get stuck on beef, and I'm not sure what the relationship is. Or could you tell me what the numbers are for beef imports from Oregon? And I don't expect you to have that with you today, but I would like to know how much beef moves out of Oregon to Taiwan, if I could.
Just as my colleague Eugene just said, we don't have specify the statistic number from a different state exporting to Taiwan. It's a hard work to trace because any kind of good export to Taiwan is we cannot trace back to which state. For example, last time when I visited Idaho State, the gentleman from their Department of Culture, they said that because the shipment, they put together in one shipment from different state, then the container goes to Taiwan port. So maybe we don't know which part is from which state. So that's kind of difficulty. Yeah.
May I also add some? Yes. As Director General said, it's hard to trace the origins. But as in our presentation, we the majority of agricultural products from Oregon are potatoes, onions, fishery products, fruits, and beef. They are mostly from other states. And but Taiwan is actually about, if my memory is correct, about the fifth largest beef consumer for U.S. beef, and the eighth for U.S. wheat. But they are mostly from the Middle East states. So actually, Oregon's wheat is still have many space to develop about in trade with Taiwan. And we are, my office is currently working hard to make a wheat purchasing delegation from Taiwan to come down to Oregon to visit. And they will go visit the relevant associations and finally will sign a intentions of purchasing. But this is what we are trying to do now. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt, but Representative Dolan covered my question and did cattle as well.
Very good. Additional questions or comments? Director General, thank you so very much for coming to our committee this morning. Please extend our very best regards to the government of Taiwan. And thank you both for your presentation this morning. Yuqi, it was very good to see you again as well.
Thank you so much for your friendship. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm now going to open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial Number 18. And first up, I'd like to call, please, Arthur Skamoulis, Dan Gardner, and Tom Chamberlain. Oops, where did Dan go? Yeah, while they're coming up, if you'd please give a summary. Thank you, Helen.
You're welcome, Chair. Chair Witt, members of the committee, House Joint Memorial 18 relates to Fast Track Authority, and Fast Track is the trade negotiating authority that's granted by Congress that allows the President to negotiate international trade agreements. Under Fast Track procedures, the President submits the legislation to Congress for approval or rejection. No amendments are allowed. And Congress has 90 legislative days to approve or reject. Congress has granted Fast Track authority five times since 1974 to presidents of both parties, and that authority is set to expire in July 2007. House Joint Memorial 18 urges the United States Congress not to reauthorize that Fast Track authority.
Thank you very much. Arthur, I suspect that you may be kicking this off, but panel, go at your leisure.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good morning. Again, my name is Arthur Stamoulis. I'm testifying this morning on behalf of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a nonprofit organization based in Portland. We very much appreciate the opportunity to voice our support for House Joint Memorial 18, a measure that urges Congress to protect states' rights in international trade agreements. This measure is very important because today's trade pacts cover far more than just tariffs and quotas. They bind both the federal government and sub-federal units of government to a wide range of provisions that constrain regulatory authority and thus threaten state sovereignty. And to date, Congress has done a poor job of encouraging the federal-state consultation and cooperation necessary to ensure that states' rights are protected during international trade negotiations and that the checks and balances inherent in our nation's federal system are upheld. And so HJM 18 weighs in on this issue by respectfully requesting that the United States Trade Representative be required to obtain the prior informed consent of the Oregon Legislative Assembly before binding the state to trade agreement obligations that affect state regulatory authority. And I'll briefly outline the three major areas in which trade agreements have impacted state sovereignty. The first is public procurement. As I'm sure you know, public procurement policies often have goals that extend far beyond the simple purchase of goods and services. It's not uncommon to find state and municipal procurement rules that aim to use public agencies' purchasing power to aid in local economic development or to help advance some other worthy goal. The procurement provisions found in most international trade pacts include non-discrimination rules that forbid purchasing agencies from giving more favorable treatment to domestic suppliers over foreign suppliers. And these provisions many times prohibit local bidder preferences, anti-offshoring measures, and other measures designed to use public procurement as a tool for encouraging local economic development. The procurement provisions found in most trade pacts also include technical specification rules that prohibit purchasing agencies from favoring one supplier over another based on how a good is made or how a service is provided. Thus, procurement policies banning everything from child labor or requiring certain environmentally friendly manufacturing methods can be prohibited under these agreements. And finally, purchasing agencies are limited in the supplier qualification rules they can establish, thus barring a foreign supplier or contractor based on its labor or environmental record can be prohibited, as are blanket bans on all bidders operating in countries with human rights abuses, such as the anti-apartheid procurement measures that many states and municipalities implemented in the 1980s. And I'll give you one example. One of the first state laws challenged under the World Trade Organization was a Massachusetts law banning purchases from companies that did business with the dictatorship in Burma. After that WTO challenge was actually used in state legislators as a lobbying point against other laws that were proposed to ban purchases from companies operating in other countries with human rights abuses. And so it's illustrative that these trade provisions have not only been used to overturn existing state policies, but they're actively being used to try to limit the establishment of new policies. The second major area is trade and services. Obviously, today's trade agreements deal with much more than just trade in goods, but cover services as well. And in particular, the World Trade Organization's General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS, limits the state's ability to make decisions regarding both the regulation and the subsidization of nearly 100 different service sectors. This includes financial services, health insurance, transportation, gambling, telecommunications, many more. And the USTR right now is proposing expanding the number of services covered to include both public and private higher education, liquid natural gas terminals, the list goes on. And the GATS under the WTO limits the regulation of services in a number of ways. First, the GATS prohibits quotas on the number of foreign-owned service providers allowed to enter this country. That sounds very reasonable. Unfortunately, federal and state bans on certain services, such as certain types of gambling, have been determined by the WTO to be a quota of zero, and thus are WTO illegal. Regulations that limit the size, location, and hours of service of many service providers can also be considered violations under the market access provision of the GATS. I'll also mention that the GATS prohibits service monopolies and requires that public subsidies and grants to any service provider be shared equally with foreign-owned businesses. Amazingly, this includes not just subsidies to American-owned businesses, but taxpayer subsidization of covered services. Thus, the subsidization of public health care, transportation, road repair, water and sewers, libraries, and more are potentially threatened by these excessively broad trade agreement provisions. And I'll give you one example of this, a solid example of how extreme these provisions have been interpreted is already on the books The United Parcel Service, you know, the company UPS, has used not the GATS but NAFTA to challenge what it calls the Canadian Postal Service's limited monopoly over letter carrying. So it has challenged the Postal Service of Canada as being illegal under these trade agreements, and it's seeking $160 million in compensation. This is a case that has already had several hearings. It has not been thrown out as ludicrous. It's moving forward. So there are severely, many times unintended or overlooked consequences to these agreements. And the last area I'll just mention briefly is special protections and privileges for foreign investors operating in the United States. These are found under the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, many of the bilateral trade agreements. And they provide provisions that give individual foreign companies the right to seek monetary compensation for complying with the laws and regulations of this country if they believe those laws and regulations hurt their profit-making ability, even if the policies in question are applied equally to both foreign and domestic companies. And these privately initiated challenges to federal, state, and municipal law are heard outside of the U.S. judicial system within private tribunals. States whose laws are challenged do not have automatic standing within these tribunals. Only the federal government does. And this, unfortunately, puts the federal government in the position at times of defending state laws with which it disagrees. Under NAFTA alone, 46 cases seeking billions of dollars of damages have been filed, challenging a host of environmental protections, food safety regulations, public procurement rules, taxpayer-subsidized public services, and even state court decisions have been challenged using these foreign investor privileges. To date, none of Oregon's laws have been challenged using these investor provisions, and the federal government has successfully fought off four of these challenges, but over $35 million of funds have already been paid out to private companies using just NAFTA's foreign investor chapter, and billions of dollars worth of cases are still pending. To cite just one example in this area, Canadian cattlemen are currently seeking more than $300 million in damages for a U.S. Food and Drug Administration decision to ban imports of certain cattle and beef products after Canadian cattle were found to contain mad cow disease. And so that's one example of the types of challenges that we're seeing under these trade agreements. And so now is a very important time to consider this issue. The trade agreement provisions that were referenced above were all negotiated and approved under by the United States Congress under a policymaking procedure known as Fast Track. Fast Track exempts international trade policies from the scrutiny of ordinary congressional committee review, amendment, and debate procedures. And as such, the ability to remedy grievances within individual trade agreement provisions is severely limited by Fast Track. As was mentioned, the current congressional grant of Fast Track expires on June 30th of this year. And given that Congress is right now reexamining its trade policy making procedures and only does so periodically, now is the perfect time to weigh in on the need for better state-federal consultation and cooperation in the trade policy arena. And at minimum, we believe that Congress should rewrite its trade policymaking rules to include an explicit mechanism for ensuring the prior informed consent of state legislators before states are bound to the non-tariff terms of a trade agreement that affects state regulatory authority. And that's exactly what HJM asked Congress to do. And I'll just mention last very briefly is that Oregon has a tradition of attempting to defend states' rights in this regard. The state has passed memorials similar to this one in the past. Governor Kulongowski has taken very important steps in trying to protect the state from the procurement provisions of these trade agreements, from the service provisions. The Attorney General has also weighed in. Unfortunately, none of the positive steps taken by the governor, the Attorney General, or the legislature has fully protected the state, and only an act of Congress can offer that protection. And so in a very timely and sensible manner, HJM 18 requests that our representatives of Congress take proactive steps to protect state sovereignty. So we urge you to support it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We stand in support of HJM 18. In 1994, when they implemented NAFTA, Oregonians were promised 3,000 jobs a year. I would, based on the data that we have, not only is fast track bad for Oregon, it's a wrong track for Oregonians. We've actually lost 68,000 jobs in this state since the implementation of NAFTA. And they're not limited to manufacturing jobs. Last week in the headlines, we all know about the reduction in force of Freightliner, where over 800 family wage jobs that paid good benefits, retirement, and health care were lost. Well, the jobs that have been created, that promise of 3,000 jobs, well, it's true. But it tends to be in the service sector, and they pay 21% less than the jobs that we have lost. And the jobs aren't limited to manufacturing. It includes call centers, engineering, radiology, research, and design. I think this is an interesting stat. The U.S. software producing industries, their employment fell by 128 jobs from 2000 to 2004, while about 100,000 new jobs producing software for export to the U.S. was created in India over the same period. Former supporters of Fast Track are now saying it was a mistake. Princeton University economist and former Federal Reserve Board Vice Chair Alan Blender is now stating loudly that a new industrial revolution will put as many as 40 million American jobs at risk in the next two decades. This will have a negative impact on our way of life in this country. We urge you to support HJM 18.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, pinch hitting today for Commissioner Dan Gardner, who was called away to another hearing down the hall. Apologize for that. Commissioner Gardner has many issues of concern regarding U.S. free trade policy. However, one of the worst aspects of it is certainly the fast-track authority, which limits debate and forbids amendments on these critical issues in the chambers of the U.S. Congress. We have a big problem in the United States. Our manufacturing job base is shrinking fast. There's plenty of evidence of this right here in Oregon, such as the recent layoff of hundreds of Freightliner workers in Portland. Those men and women lost high-paying, family-wage jobs. They will now struggle to pay their mortgages, to pay for food, or for health insurance. The community in the state of Oregon is worse off for this. This is a dangerous trend indeed. Trade agreements such as CAFTA limit states' ability to set procurement policies designed to aid in local economic development or to help achieve other worthwhile goals. Commissioner Gardner introduced legislation this session, Senate Bill 201, which would strengthen our state government's ability to contract for services with companies that employ Oregonians. I'm happy this bill is now moving ahead under legislative sponsorship as House Bill 3301, and I urge your support for both HJM 18 and that measure. We need to protect jobs here in Oregon and the United States. We need to do everything we can to protect this nation's middle-class workers. Commissioner Gardner urges your support for House Joint Memorial 18 and thanks you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Folby.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I support, I guess, the idea of House Joint Memorial 18. I'm just kind of curious why we wouldn't include obtaining the permission from the executive branch of government as well as the Legislative Assembly in this particular memorial.
The feeling is that the Legislative Assembly is the body closest to the people in the state. It has a greater diversity, obviously, within it. And it also has committees that are able to consider individual questions like how does this impact the state's energy policy? How does this impact the state's tax policy? Well, certainly the executive branch could weigh in on. We felt that the legislative branch is in a better position to make decisions regarding.
Yes, Vice Chair Lum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fast tracks are supposed to be moving fast. That's why it's a fast track. And this memorial is a resolution, and that the memorial is concept is a good thing. but that when tried to be approved by the each state, it's very difficult, very slow in this fast-pacing world economy. And can you comment that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Lin, thank you for that question. The trade agreements in question tend to be developed over a very long time period. We believe that there are many opportunities for the USTR to check in with the states on in the areas that impact state regulatory authority. Many times the language impacting state regulatory authority is very similar, if not identical, from trade agreement to trade agreement. So it would be very easy for the USTR to start that conversation early on in the process. We also feel, quite frankly, that these agreements are moving forward too quickly, that it's appropriate to slow down the process to a certain extent. But, you know, what I'm suggesting is that there is a good amount of time available right now for the USTR to check in with states, to have states weigh in and to either opt in or opt out, and that, you know, that how that happens can still be determined by the states and by the USTR.
I have a follow-up question.
Please.
Thank you very much. Fair trade agreement, I agree. I don't think anyone can dispute that. But when you are assessing this trade issue, you gave us some information detrimental to our state, to our country, but you didn't mention what benefit we are getting out of this CAFTA. To my information, we export 20% to Canada, while we're importing about 16 to 17%. So apparently, we are getting some benefit out of it. And then, how can you assess and answer that questions?
Well, I'm Chair Witt, Representative Lim. It goes from country to country. You picked out Canada, where we actually have a surplus in trade. But if you look globally, with the nations around the world, we're in a deficit. That's why we have a trade deficit. And what also needs to be included in this discussion is the total lack of environmental or labor standards in these trade agreements, human rights standards. That's what Fast Track has got us. What is the quickest way to get from point A to point B? And it's not benefiting the workers of this country. It's not benefiting the environment. All it does is benefit corporate interests, which I believe in corporations. Believe me, I like jobs. But the point is, we can't continue down a path that creates sub-family wage jobs and think we're winning the trade argument. We're not.
Mr. Chair, if I can add one point to that. I certainly our organization is not against these trade agreements. Certainly there are benefits to trade. What HGM 18 asks is that the state be able to opt in or opt out of the provisions that would preempt state regulations already on the book and state regulatory authority. It does not say we're not going to trade, we're not going to enter into a trade agreement. It says before you preempt state regulatory authority, please check in with us and give us prior informed consent on that.
Representative Gerard.
Actually, a follow-up on Representative Lim's and some of your last comments. I agree with the context of most of this. The problem I have is the consent of 50 different legislatures before a trade agreement can be agreed. That's sort of what you're asking for in this agreement. You use the words check-in, but you use the word consent in the form here, and there's a lot of difference between checking in and consent, because I don't see 50 different states all agreeing to a trade agreement. I just don't see that ever happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now the USTR will decide on its own to what extent it's going to consult with states before it it obligates the states to various trade provisions. The USTR is currently asking state governors whether they want to be bound to the procurement provisions of trade agreements. At some points it hasn't. At some points it has, then it goes back again and will not ask. There's nothing, to my knowledge, within federal law requiring it to do so. It sort of does it, you know, out of the goodness of its own heart when it chooses to do so. And so right now, currently, it asks governors, would you like to be bound to these procurement provisions or not? And governors have said yes or no. It's not a very long or laborious process. It doesn't require a rewriting of the entire trade agreement. It's a checkoff box. Will the state of Oregon be bound to these provisions or will it not be? That is a process that we believe needs to happen across the board in a number of different provisions, not just procurement, and that it's most appropriate for legislatures to consider that issue. Governor Kulikowski has done an excellent job of weighing in where he's able to. He's approached the USTR on issues like trade and services. A year ago, asked the USTR not to bind the state anymore to the service provisions of trade agreements. To the best of my knowledge, the USTR never responded to that request. There's nothing in the law requiring the USTR to respond to that request. We'd like to see the USTR be required to simply inform the states when it's going to bind the states to various provisions that impact their regulatory authority and allow the states to decide whether or not they will be bound.
Representative Dolan.
Your recommendation for change of the status quo on trade agreements certainly finds a soft spot over here. But wouldn't it be, I'm concerned, world trade is at a hectic pace. I don't want to be left out. But wouldn't we be better to tack a course, and I'm not sure that the reach of our legislature can go that far, but to mandate that labor be considered and ask HAR 18 to carry the message that if we're going to put our workers at an unfair disadvantage, then consideration has to be made. Rather than asking, we do get state approval from the governors, but I'm fearful of the bureaucracy we have added. I want an answer. If I don't get a better one, I guess I'll have to go with this one. But I would like a better answer than this. It seems bureaucratic, time-consuming, and inhibiting trade. Find a question in there somewhere.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, again, I want to reiterate that HGM 18 does not attempt in any way to stop these trade agreements. It does not attempt to bind the states to the tariff and quota terms of trade agreements, which are generally promoted as the most important means of increasing trade. What it asks, again, as I believe we're all clear, is that the state legislators be given the opportunity to weigh in on whether or not they want to be bound to the terms that limit state authority. And, you know, it doesn't specify the mechanism under which the states would be bound. The state legislature, I believe, would be free to pass a law, you know, spelling out any mechanism it chose that would streamline the process, reduce bureaucracy, make things as quick as easy as possible. I personally believe that it's very appropriate to take a close look at these trade agreements before just rushing forward with them. But again, what this says is that the federal government should consult with the states, and the states should have the right to opt in or opt out to having their laws and regulations internationally preempted.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just since part of my question, and actually my question was already asked, I'm just going to make a comment. Three things. The quota and tariffs are excluded from this, and that's the purview of the U.S. government. I would like to see, as I believe Representative Hovey expressed earlier, maybe the governor's office be included in this, as well as the legislature. And thirdly, personally, I prefer quality to speed in almost everything, and I believe that this is a good case place for that to be examined. Thank you.
Mark, does Bureau of Labor and Industries have regulatory authority over licensing in the state of Oregon?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, we have some regulatory authority over licensing, such as farm labor contractors and folks like that. We don't have broad licensing authority.
Uh-huh. I'm just curious, some of the provisions that the three of you might recommend. I'm making the presumption that none of you is opposed to international trade per se, but I'm wondering, in addition, I've heard suggestions about human rights provisions, heard suggestions of environmental protections, labor protections. I'm presuming that would include, of course, child labor protections. There are other provisions that the three of you see as being helpful to include in international trade agreements.
Chair Witt, I think Arthur spelled them out. A lot of it is to do with state sovereignty. You mentioned licensing. Not only does Boley license, but the state of Oregon licenses contractors, licenses electricians, licensed plumbers, a number of different areas, plus regulatory authority over casinos and a whole host of other state sovereignty issues that Arthur spelled out. So I think what can be included to improve trade agreements are very broad. The problem is this fast-track method, which is a cookie-cutter attempt to trade agreements, really doesn't take into consideration those areas we've just talked about.
Great. Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments for the panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate your attendance here. Representative Clem, did you want to testify on HJM 18?
Well, I'm going to testify on the next bill. I thought maybe I would, any comments I have about this, I could just feed into that.
Very good. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up Erica Mahari and Corey Cliff, please. Before you begin your testimony, I'd just like to announce to the public, too, that amendments are still not ready for House Bill 2206. Late breaking news here. We were informed this morning from Legislative Council, and because of that, I'm going to hold a work session over on that bill. My apologies. I'm just not going to say any more.
Chair, but for those that have traveled, will you, without the work session, you do some public hearing?
Yes, we'll do a public hearing, but we will not be, thank you very much, Representative Dahlem. We will do a public hearing on that bill, but we will not be working it today. That clarification was important. Thank you. Please proceed. Welcome.
Chair,
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Joint Memorial 18. My name is Erica Maharg, and I live in Portland. I am the Global Trade Issue Coordinator for the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. The Oregon Chapter represents 24,000 members across the state, and the Sierra Club, as many of you probably know, is the oldest and largest environmental organization in the country. The Oregon Chapter Sierra Club and its members are concerned about the nation's current model for trade policy, and we see Fast Track, or the Trade Promotion Authority, as a primary reason the current model persists in the manner in which it does. First of all, as the last people testifying said, the Sierra Club is not anti-trade. However, as an environmental organization, we are concerned about the proven environmental impacts of trade policy. What is most disconcerting to the Sierra Club is the way in which these trade agreements are passed and how they cut off participation from our elected leaders, state and local governments, and citizens. In my written testimony, I've written briefly about how it cuts off national congressional leaders' input and citizens' voices, but I'm going to concentrate primarily on states' interests right now. First of all, Oregon has always been a national leader in enacting important environmental regulations. We led the country in first clean water standards, and we have been a model for our land use laws. We all understand that this is one of the reasons Oregon is as unique and as wonderful as it is. And these actions occurred because our leaders, our state leaders like yourselves, have not waited to take the initiative to protect our standard of living. Unfortunately, Fast Track and current trade policy undermines our state's sovereign right to take that initiative. Although no Oregon environmental law has yet been challenged as a barrier to trade, we cannot forget that this is certainly a real possibility. In spring of 2006, Governor Kulongoski sent a letter to the United States Trade Representative asking Oregon to be removed from new GATS, General Agreement and Trade and Services provisions, because of their potential impact on Oregon's ability to create regulations that it feels necessary to protect its citizenry. At that time, also in that letter, Kulongoski expressed concern about current GATS provisions that could already affect our land use and zoning laws. And I want to give a short example of how this could formulate itself. There was a case in Mexico where a local government denied a permit to a U.S. corporation who had applied for a toxic waste dump. Now, the local government in Mexico denied that permit because the dump threatened or would threaten the community's drinking water supply. The U.S. corporation challenged the local government's decision under NAFTA. Common sense tells us that the local government's decision was a simple public health policy. However, under NAFTA, this decision was prohibited, and Mexico was forced to pay $16.7 million for that decision to the company. It's no secret that Oregon is facing numerous environmental challenges currently. Measure 37 has put our land use system in an upheaval, and I know the legislature is working hard to create a workable system. Additionally, in the absence of federal action, Oregon, like many states, is beginning to take the initiative to fight global warming. But along with our land use policy and global warming, there is the potential that the initiatives we may take to protect our citizenry and to protect our environment may conflict with trade agreements. Ultimately, the required mandates of trade agreements compromise our ability to deal with perhaps the largest environmental challenges we face. At the very least, the Oregon legislature, as a representative of its people and a body that makes important decisions to protect the local and perhaps the global environment, should be consulted, and consent should be required before the sovereign right to regulate is usurped from them. With the passage of HJM 18, the Oregon legislature is making the statement that the current system for passing trade agreements does not work appropriately for states, its citizens, or its environment. This does not mean that trade agreements will not be passed in the future. It simply means that we will pass them with the appropriate amount of stakeholder input upon which our democracy is based. Thank you again for your time. I and the 24,000 members of the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club urge you to support House Joint Memorial 18.
Thank you very much. Welcome and good morning.
Thank you. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak with you today in support of HJM 18. My name is Corey Cliff. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and as a member of the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. In 2001, the Oregon legislature approved, with only one dissenting vote, Senate Joint Memorial 2, which sent a message to the U.S. Congress asking for special congressional committees to be set up, which would study how trade agreements threaten state and local lawmaking authority, and also to study how trade agreements are affecting Oregon communities. Members of my economic justice group helped to author and lobby the passage of SJM 2 in 2001. We've been learning and educating others, both locally and across the country, around issues and the impacts of international trade agreements, which are the legal framework which helps to promote economic globalization. Trade agreements such as the GATT, General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, and most recently CAFTA, are written largely with input mostly from large transnational corporations, with very little input or no input from elected officials, local labor leaders, environmental or human rights advocates. Be assured that we are not opposed to international trade. We are, however, very concerned, and we need to engage in responsible trade. We feel that trade agreements disproportionately benefit the wealthy and powerful corporate interest at the expense of national and local sovereignty, middle class and living wage jobs, and stewardship of the environment. We feel that Oregon laws should not be allowed to be challenged by foreign corporations in secret international trade tribunals and accused of creating barriers to trade as the only criteria, as they are under the current trade agreements. Our elected representatives need to have the opportunity to review trade agreements in detail, hold debates and public hearings similar to this context that we have here today, and have the ability to make amendments which reflect the highest ideals of the citizens of this country, of we the people. Since the passage in Oregon of SJM 2 in 2001, concerns over the disparities enshrined in the trade agreements have only increased. I'm here today to ask you to support House Joint Memorial 18, which would send another strong message to Congress not to give away their responsibilities to legislate on our behalf and not to renew Trade Promotion Authority, which is coming up for renewal in June. I've included in my written testimony a copy of a short booklet that my Economic Justice Action Group published in 2002 titled Why Americans Are Free and Why Foreign Corporations Are Attacking Our Freedoms. It's a concise overview of the concerns of our concerns as Oregonians surrounding trade agreements. And I've also included a copy of Senate Joint Memorial 2, which passed in 2001. Thank you very much for your time and thoughtful consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Since you mentioned SJR 2, which was introduced in 2001, mm-hmm. and can you see the differences between HJM 18 currently, the one, and SJM 2? Can you describe the differences between the two?
I believe the differences, Chair and Representative Lim, I believe that the differences largely go into the level of detail. SJM 2 really only addressed some of the specific concerns with the disparities that were included in international trade agreements. SJM 2 went into those only briefly, whereas I believe HJM 18 goes into them in much more detail and more clearly spells out some of the concerns and frankly problems that we're concerned with. And also, I believe Senate Joint Memorial 2 did not specifically address fast track authority, whereas I believe that is sort of a central focus on the current HJM 18.
and comment, Mr.
Please.
Chair. And as I read HJM18, it's it's already mentioned, obtain informed consent in advance. That's the very strong language in here. But as I read HJM2, it doesn't require only urge. So there's a vast differences in it, as I read it. So this is requiring the consent that the SJR2 is just urging the Congress to look at this issue.
Chairman Whitten, Representative Lim, I believe that's true, and I think that part of the reasoning I believe for that is that as we've had 6 or 7 years since SJM2 was passed, I think that our concerns have not diminished, but probably increased. And so I believe that, I was not involved in the crafting of the language of HJM18. I believe that we felt that stronger language was needed.
Thank you.
Erica, you made mention to the very severe problems that we face with global warming, and you also made reference to some problems that could be created in trying to address global warming. And without trying to put you on the spot, I'm wondering if you could think of a scenario by which the United States or Oregon, either one, would attempt to diminish the impacts of global warming, and how we thereby might run afoul of international trade.
Right. It's Chairman Witt, it's a very difficult question, I think, because right now, first of all, I'm not an energy policy expert, so it's hard for me to really think about specific examples, and I would be happy to research actual state initiatives that are happening right now on global warming and try to come up with some clear answers for you. But I think particularly, you know, if we decided, for instance, in our procurement policy to write in environmental standards about
automobiles.
Right. It could potentially run afoul. I mean, I'm being very careful because I know that legal issues are very wonky. So I don't want to be too general, but you know, I think that, you know, particularly with procurement, could be a real issue. And as a state and as citizens, that is primarily one of our biggest pieces of power, is in our consumer power. And I think that is definitely something that we all have to consider when we are being signed on to two trade agreements that involve undermining our power to regulate.
Fine. Thank you very much. Further questions? Appreciate your testimony
Thank
very
you.
Much. Thank you. We can have Rick North and Mike Sullivan come up, please. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Good morning to you. Who's going to go first?
Is that okay?
Your choice.
Okay, I can go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Rick North. I'm a resident of Durham, Oregon. And for the last 3.5 years, I have been the director of the Campaign for Safe Food Project of the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And previous to that, I had worked for 21 years as for the American Cancer Society, and the last 5 as the state director for ACS. So all told, I've had nearly 30 years experience in public health. I'm not a doctor, by the way. I just work with a lot of them. I'm not here today representing a particular organization, just my own personal opinion. The issue at hand is the international trade agreements and about preemption. I just wanted to touch on two aspects of preemption that I've had experience with. They don't pertain specifically to the international trade, but I just wanted to give you what I've seen and how preemption has been used. The first involves secondhand tobacco smoke. And there's no scientific dispute about how deadly it is. It makes people sick and it kills them. 49,000 per year in the United States, according to the Surgeon General. So consequently, many cities and counties in the United States pass laws against secondhand smoke. And what the tobacco industry did, you could guess, and I had a quote in here on my testimony. I just wanted to read that to you from Victor Crawford. It's one of their chief lobbyists. The Tobacco Institute and tobacco companies' first priority has always been to preempt the field, preferably to put it all on the federal level, but if they can't do that, at least on the state level, because the health advocates can't compete with me on a state level. And unfortunately for many states, he was right, and Oregon was one of them. And the state legislature here passed a preemption law in 2001 covering any city or county that hadn't previously passed a smoke-free air law. So if you wanted to pass a law now in Coos Bay or Ontario or wherever, more stringent than the state law, you can't do it on secondhand smoke. In the second example, I want to get to food here. We've had a system for years where the FDA and Congress determines most of our food safety and labeling rules for the country. The state and local governments have always had the authority to go beyond those federal laws and the FDA rules. Just to give you some examples, all 50 states regulate milk safety, going beyond the federal standards. 16 states have laws establishing shellfish safety beyond the federal. California passed a law limiting the amount of lead that they could get in candy because they've had problems with that. This is imported candy, by the way. Alaska, to inform their residents, passed a law labeling for salmon. So it has to be labeled either wild or farmed. In Oregon, Oregon has a law on adulteration of food. So if it's been affected by something like fire or flood or irradiation or chemicals, it has to be labeled so that consumers can tell something has happened to this food. And you may be aware, 1985, right here in Salem, a 10-year-old girl died from eating vegetables from a restaurant that had been treated with sulfites. And the FDA had already been warned about this. There had already been examples that sulfites on fresh fruits and vegetables were seriously hurting people and killing many of them. But they had not taken any action. But 2 months after this happened in Oregon, the Oregon State Legislature did take action and said, no more. We're putting a ban on it. And it wasn't until over a year later that the FDA finally did and passed a similar rule saying you could not put sulfites on fresh fruits and vegetables in restaurants. By that time, 18 more people had died, and 300 had their health seriously hurt. So there's a common thread here, and that thread is when preemption wins, public health loses. And with this fast track up for renewal, we've got the opportunity to reverse the worst possible scenario, which I think is international preemption. And this isn't even preemption from an elected government body at all. So trade issues are important, and like everybody else, I certainly don't have a problem with international trade. Don't have any problem with corporations making money or anything like that. So a certain amount of uniformity is desirable. But when everything else is subordinated to just maximizing profits, food safety or public health standards, or just the ability of Oregonians or all Americans to make their own decisions, we just think the tail is wagging the dog here. So I firmly believe that fast-track authority undermines our sovereignty and undermines democracy itself. So I strongly urge you to vote yes on HJM 18. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I'm here to ask you to support this bill, this memorial, in behalf of AWPPW. There you go. That tongue ties me every time. I come from the steelworkers, go to the AWPPW. But anyway, as we stand now here in Oregon, we're only 2,000 strong. There's almost 5,000 pulp and paper mills in China to date. That's not including what will come with the dam that they're putting in. Excuse me. And then you turn around here locally in Oregon, the environmental group in this state wants pulp paper industry to be pristine as all get out, when in fact the rivers, as far as pulp and paper goes, are the cleanest in the world. So you see, for us it's a double-edged sword. We're asked to hold the tolerance much higher here in Oregon than our competitors are overseas. Thomas Jefferson in his day said the merchant's only allegiance is to the mere ground he stands on while he sells his wares. Translated, capitalism will move to where it will make the most profit. And he was worried about that then. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson was so worried about the erosion of domestic industry, he put a 50% tariff on goods coming in to save the American economy. So it's not a new issue, but this is the first time that I know of that trade agreements have not dealt with the sovereignty of the nations. And that's the issue. We, the industrial worker, are the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, and we're dying. But it'll get the humans and all societies after time. I have four examples that I remember from the WTO and were lightly touched on earlier. One was Venezuela sued the American government, EPA, because they said our standards were too high for their oil. The WTO, which I might add meets in private, is appointed, never elected, agreed with Venezuela, and now we have dirty oil coming into this country. Laws that we wanted as people of this country have been circumvented by a group of three people we don't know. We don't know where they meet. Another one is the Burma idea, the idea that the Burmese government was having atrocious human relations with the people, if I can say it that way. Brutality is better. And so the state decided we don't want to do any procurement with a country like that. Well, they went to the WTO, and you guessed it. The WTO tribunal went with Burma and forced your state, Massachusetts, to trade with them. There was the case of a woman, and I got to see her up in Seattle in November of 1999 at the WTO battle for Seattle. And it was a real eye-opener for me. Here's this black woman from the West Indies, who grows bananas. If you're like me, I thought the bananas grew in a jungle. Not so. 40 plot lots, etc. There's over 200,000 of them. Chiquita Banana sued against these independent growers because the European market had made restitution for the slavery of years past and gave them a little bit more for the product. And so Chiquita sued that it was unfair and discriminated against the ability to make a profit, and Chiquita was going to win, last I heard. I don't know the conclusion to that one. The other one is the TEDS. The TEDS are turtle extrusion devices that were used by shrimpers in our country. When the Southeast Asian shrimping countries found that out, they sued because they said it was too expensive for them to equip their nets to allow the turtles to be expelled out of the netting, and we lost that. I mean, the Europeans did not want hormones in their beef. The U.S. company sued and won against them in the WTO, and now the Europeans, against their own will, if they want, have to eat our beef. I mean, and it goes on and on. And as I said, as bad as it is for the industrial worker, it's worse on the sovereignty of our nation and every nation I can think of. Back in 1989, the United Steelworkers of America, which I was a member of for 39 years, sometimes I think I'm about 89, but sued with a group called Made in America. They sued the American government because, the way I understood it, NAFTA was a treaty. And treaties have to be ratified by 66 and two-thirds of the Senate. It was ratified by 63.9. Well, The word's legalism. It went through the courts. It's in the Supreme Court. I don't know what the determination was, but the last I heard was that it's not a treaty. It's a presidential agreement. But in the real world, we all know it is a treaty, and there are only four: peace, war, military, and commerce. So we're letting down our own people, our own Americans. When I was in Washington, D.C. in 2001 with other steelworkers from this state in Washington, we walked around and talked to every politician we could from either state. A couple of things that I said to them is I asked, can you name an empire in the world that didn't have the ability to make metal? Of course, there isn't any, and we're going there. The other one I asked is, why should we elect you and pay you salaries when three people I don't even know can go somewhere, make a decision, and circumvent the laws that you've enacted? What's the sense in it? I mean, to me, it's that personal. It gets my dander up that much. If it takes too long to get together and do, I beg to offer this, that the European Union took 10 years to get together because what they got out of it was all the workers got the best safety, health standards of all the nations. You don't hear the complaints from them that you hear about NAFTA and GATT and the WTO as you do in North America. The other thing about time-consuming and doing a document is their own constitution, which took a whole summer. And it is a perfect document, but I would offer that it's been amended many, many times. This needs to be repealed and put something in that has people's mind and heart and soul. I thank you. I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Is there anyone else from the public? I know that Representative Clem wants to testify. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify this morning on House Joint Memorial 18? I am going to momentarily keep this memorial open and also open a public hearing on House Bill 3448. And if I could please ask Representative Clem to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from House District 21 here in Central and East Salem, and I'm a chief co-sponsor on both of these pieces of legislation, so I did want to comment. I worked for Congress while we, in 1994, I worked for Oregon Congressman while GATT was negotiated, and I was a staff person and took a lot of the phone calls from people concerned on both sides of the issue, went to a lot of town halls with my boss all over his district in the 3rd Congressional District in Portland, and after became a senator all over Oregon talking about trade, and over the last really 13 years, my thinking has evolved a lot. After I left his office, I went to work on an orchard that my wife's family owns with her dad, where trade policies are huge, and followed me there. After the, in my view, the trade policies of our country ruined the economy of our particular orchard and in the pear industry, I started a service-oriented business that I didn't think could be outsourced, and that's what I do to make money now, is fix computers. So I have very strong opinions about this topic because of my own sort of evolution of my life. On 18, I really don't think the fast-track authority has worked well. I do think that it's certainly the right of our country, and we should participate in fair trade with other countries. On our orchard in particular, and in the pear industry, we export a tremendous amount of fruit. So often you'll find farmers, because the American Farm Bureau is generally supportive of these kinds of things, you'll find some farmers, though, who don't agree that this has worked out very well for us overall. And so the way to solve the problem for me isn't to eliminate trade, because we still need to trade. It's to have the most fair trading process with the most leverage we can possibly get. And the way I think we do that is by letting our members of Congress, who represent the areas of the country that are most affected by these participate in the trade negotiations to some extent. Fast track authority really removes that away, where you just get an up or down vote at the very end, and it would be like asking you all to not sit in this committee, to delegate one person unelected to go hear this testimony, and later you don't get a chance to ask me questions, you don't get a chance to offer amendments, you just get an up or down vote, and that would be extremely frustrating as a member of Congress to do that. So what we're doing is saying to Congress, stop doing fast track, don't stop doing trade agreements, stop doing fast track and replace it with something better that's more fair to the states and the members of Congress who want to be involved in representing their districts in effect. Fast track authority process cannot be, because they only get an up or down vote at the end and they don't get to participate in any formal way. They can write letters. They can call the trade representative and say what they want from their district. But that's different than being elected to represent your district and then getting to vote on a treaty. And the idea, you know, for me at least, the idea that that NAFTA or GATT were not treaties, that they were agreements, and therefore we don't have to follow our constitutional rules around treaties, is bogus. So that's my piece on House JM 18, is I don't think fast track is the right way to do trade agreements. It leaves people out that need to be represented, and it leaves congressional people out who need to be in that decision. Do you want me to stop there and take any questions and before I talk about the other?
Any questions or comments? Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing any.
Okay. House Bill 3448 is another bill that, along with Representative Chris Edwards, I co-sponsored. It essentially says that we do not want, as Oregonians, to have our tax dollars used through tax credits, tax deductions made available, or subtractions, in promoting outsourcing of jobs overseas. That's the basic argument here. And, you know, I'm a business owner. I believe in the free market. We export our fruit. I have a service business that is a domestic entity. It doesn't do business overseas. But that's my choice. One of my businesses, I do business overseas. Another business, I don't. That's my choice. I think it's in Oregonians' interest to promote the activities that employ people here. I don't think it's in the interest of Oregonians to have their tax dollars being used to subsidize my private profitable activity, some years profitable, to sell my fruit overseas. So my belief is the tax credits, tax available, tax deductions, subtractions that are available for domestic employment, Oregon employment, I think that is in the taxpayers' interest to help keep those activities healthy and vibrant through tax policy. I don't think it is to export the jobs overseas. So how do you get at that? Well, one is you try and find all the tax credits that might lead to moving jobs overseas. And that's one approach. This approach is slightly different. It says you take an average number of employees in Oregon in a tax year. You take an average number of employees for the same company overseas. And if the overseas goes up and the Oregon goes down, then or the one goes up and the other holds flat, then they lose tax deductions, tax credits, tax subtractions. Now, I've been thinking more about this. One thing that I think we do want to promote is the selling of Oregon products overseas. So I would think an amendment would be appropriate, actually, that dealt with sales positions and positions related to promoting products. But I'm very concerned about the future of this country in terms of the loss of the manufacturing base, the loss of the good working class jobs. I grew up in Coos Bay. There are a myriad of reasons why those mills closed, but one of which is some of the activities got moved overseas. And it's the company's choice to do that. It's a free market. That's their right. Taxpayers don't have to help subsidize that activity, though. That is something that should be done on its own merits for the board of that company to decide if they want to do. And that's the basic philosophy about this. The tax code is used to incent and disincent behavior all the time. I think we need to find ways to incent people to keep the jobs here in Oregon. And my preference is to do things like help market brand Oregon and sell more products so no one wants to move their jobs overseas. That's my preference, but that's not been working so well. We are losing here in Salem, certainly in farming, we are losing acres to other countries consistently. We are losing companies to other countries consistently. And we're going to have to get more aggressive about how to do it. One of the big concerns about GAAP for me and the investor protection provisions inside the WTO is we have some of our laws on the hook for reimbursement to the investors. I've read a piece of a document that I didn't hear the person testify, but from one of the Pacific Northwest International Trade Association, and there seems to be some dispute about whether a WTO trade tribunal can actually cancel a law. They say no. I heard other people testify yes. You know, I haven't researched out the truth of either claim. But what I do know is there are investor protection provisions. We're kind of like Measure 37, actually. If you're a foreign investor and you believe a state of Oregon law has put your investor profits at risk, even though it might have been to promote Oregon companies, you can ask for compensation. So later this week, I have a teamwork bill with several members both sides of the aisle to talk about giving preferential purchasing for Oregon companies with Oregon tax dollars to try and incent our own companies with our own tax dollars. I assume that would easily be something that could be drawn in front of the WTO and say, no, sorry, we lost a contract. We're now suing you for the profits. Some secret trade tribunal decides that the law that we brought on a bipartisan basis maybe gets passed, maybe becomes law, could be canceled. I didn't run for office to have some trade tribunal cancel the laws that I worked through this building. So this is one that gets my hackles up as well, particularly because, you know, I've seen such a massive loss in our own orchard income. I mean, we basically, the year before some of the trade agreements and other factors that are in farming came into effect, you know, we used to net out maybe $100,000 in a good year, $80,000 to $100,000. We haven't made more than $10,000 in 7 years. We've lost money most of those years. The only real change has been little bits of increases in costs, fuel, labor, but that doesn't explain 100% loss in income. The big ones have been the rise of Argentinian and other fruits coming into our market, and we used to have tariffs and other ways to try and make that even. We kind of got out of that model with these trade agreements, but it's not working. And that's why you see all the Measure 37 claims in Hood River. You know, the product labeling laws that people call for in Hood River, where we wish that Americans would help use their market choices to buy fruits and vegetables and products and buy made in America. But in the meantime, I would like to at least take the tax subsidies away while we hope people regain some consumer loyalty for products that are made and grown here in the United States.
Vice Chair Lim. Riley, excuse me.
That's all right.
Me?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In basketball, that'd be a good play.
I'm a signatory on 3448 as well, and I also see a couple of areas where we might have some amendments to this. I would like to see us look very carefully at the type of positions that we're talking about, and do those positions that are created overseas supplant the ones that we're losing in Oregon? I'd like to see that looked at carefully.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's completely fair. And part of what's evolving, I had I worked on computers this weekend for some customers, and one of my customers is proving to me that the free market may work in some regards. They got me on the phone with this guy from Dell who told him to go hire someone locally because he couldn't figure it out. And I got on the phone with them. You know, he was trying to work off of a book, but the English wasn't particularly good, and he really didn't understand what was going on. It took me about 8 minutes to solve a problem they had spent something like 70 hours on the phone with over the last week. They basically need to click one button and uninstall a piece of software. That was it. Could not figure it out. Hopefully the consumers will wake up and say, wow, we're going to use local service people and not, you know, somebody in another country who has difficulty understanding the language, and so they don't relate. That person would be better for servicing computer users in their country. Potentially, but I don't know if we're going to get there. So I think we need to look at the kinds of jobs that are clearly outsourcing, that aren't, you know, that aren't growing Oregon businesses, but they're outsourcing.
Representative Rive.
Well, yeah, I have a question on some language. Lines 4 through 7. You're talking about what you're trying to achieve here. I think what you're asking for is that if you pay Oregon tax, then you get a deduction from federal tax.
Is that what we're talking here, or are we talking all deductions, or what are we talking?
Well, I'm not sure that 4 through 7 came out the way we wanted. I was reading it back there myself, eyeballing it a little more closely, and it's a little confusing. So I do think we need some work in that area.
Yeah. What are you trying to... I can understand the tax credit part. I mean, if we're going to tax credit, I have a problem. But, I mean, heck, health care is a deduction, so, I mean, we want people to have health insurance, so I mean you can't eliminate all deductions. If you're talking the deduction of Oregon tax, that's a different matter. So what's your intent there?
I think for me personally, and I don't know about the other co-sponsors, but I think tax credits certainly and any other kinds of programs beyond promoting the sale are what I'm interested in. Tax deductions, like when you buy a printer here, should you be able to write off the printer, you know, for use here, if you had a net gain in foreign employment over your employment here, if you're a company owner? I don't know that I want to go that far. I mean, in theory, yeah, but the damage to the economy would not be something that I would find favorable. That's where I'm thinking. As I read it, I thought, boy, that's pretty steep. All deductions. But I do feel strongly that we find ways to get people to keep the jobs here. In looking at it, I think that probably is a little steep because I think most people would just relocate their companies elsewhere.
Once you started down the slippery slope and you lost all your deductions, that would tube you.
Yeah. Now, the choice is to not move the jobs overseas, too, but, you know, this is probably a little heavy-handed, even for me.
I'd like to follow up because the problem I see is there could be a logical reason that some overseas a company is doing well that has nothing to do with the outsourcing of jobs here, and there would have to be some way to absolutely do a correlation, and that would have to be written in here as well.
I would be open to amendments that it's kind of like Representative Riley talked about, sort of create a more direct relationship between the two activities.
Okay.
What's your rabbit?
Yes, and I just want to follow up on what Representative Gerard was saying. And I signed on to this, and the wording isn't exactly the way we thought it was going to come out.
Right.
And there are a couple of other bills that are in the mix somewhere. One of which would put some teeth into the stipulation of why we give credits, and I think that's an even much more important way to go. Is does this credit that we give actually create jobs here? And those stipulations have some teeth and clawbacks. So I think there are some amendments needed here.
Yeah. When I thought about deductions in my head when we asked them to draft the bill, it was about deductions even that were specifically related to outsourcing a job. So if you got to write off the somehow against your Oregon or federal income, well, your Oregon income, actually. If you got to write off against your Oregon income the building of a plant that was exactly the same thing that just closed here, like, you know, the example, and I don't know all the details, but a Freightliner really built one at one point at the same time they were closing another one, it's the exact same jobs, I don't know that you should get to deduct off your Oregon income the cost of building the other one over there here. But things that are completely unrelated to, you know, the outsourcing, like buying your paper and your health care and all that kind of stuff, that's probably a little excessive.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Clem, thank you very, very much.
I'm becoming a regular in front of your committee. I'll try to stay away for at least a day.
Okay, next I'd like to call up, please, Amy Wilson. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll be brief. Chair Witt, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to let me testify in front of you this morning. For the record, my name's Amy Wilson, and I'm here representing the Service Employees International Union. SEIU represents over 45,000 workers in Oregon who provide critical services across the state. And we're proud to support House Bill 3448 for two reasons. One, because it's good public policy to encourage employment in Oregon, and because our state needs to direct every possible dollar towards investing in ways that strengthen our economy and protect vital services. With the savings generated by eliminating tax breaks for companies that send jobs out of state, we'll be able to keep more money in Oregon's economy and invest in programs that build Oregon's future. We can invest more in higher education to strengthen Oregon's workforce. We can invest in child care for working families, helping employers retain employees and increase the financial stability of Oregon families. House Bill 3488 is about converting tax loopholes into investments for Oregon's future. And we urge your support.
Thank you very, very much, Amy. Questions? Yes, Vice Chair. Boy, this is twice. Riley.
I haven't shaved my beard off yet.
At least he hasn't told you about it.
Yeah, right. Amy, thank you for coming and sharing your testimony. And I agree with almost everything you said. In fact, everything you said. And I believe that we do need to amend this bill to be sure that we actually are achieving the goals that you stated. And we need to make sure that we're not harming Oregon's economy by some of our actions when we really mean to help it. So I like the thought that this bill creates, and I want to make sure that we actually do what we think we are doing. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your coming. Anyone else from the public to testify on House Bill 3448? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Joint Memorial 18 and House Bill 3448. And with that, we have one remaining bill, as announced earlier. We don't have the amendments for House Bill 2206. However, we have had some folks who've shown up from considerable distance to testify on that bill. I'm going to open a public hearing on it and ask Representative Dahlem to please do the first introduction.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Last week, Dick Feeney and Dick Knight came to my office, both from PSU. Today we have Dick Knight here, and I'm going to ask him to tell us about the relationship between House Bill 2206 and Portland State University. I think he signed up as a neutral witness, so it's appropriate that we lead first with neutrality and then opponents and proponents. Dick is on the advisory board, and with that, I'd like all of you to hear what he had to say to me in my office.
Thank you, Representative Witt, Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem, and committee members for the opportunity to speak with you. I'm Dick Knight, and I'm representing the advisory board to the Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science at Portland State University. I'd like to discuss briefly with you the outstanding work that the Engineering and Technology Investment Council, or ETIC, is doing, and urge your support for this highly successful program as you consider options for workforce and economic development in Oregon. The Advisory Board of the Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science is a volunteer group whose 30-plus members come from companies in high technology, transportation, civil engineering, structural design, architecture, and software. These companies cover the range from Oregon's largest to smallest employers. My own background is similar, having spent much of my career as a vice president at Tektronix and then as chief operating officer of a startup technology company. Our advisory board meets frequently throughout the year in order to understand, advise, and support the Massey College in meeting the needs of engineering education in Oregon. The Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science is a key resource for both economic development and for developing a highly skilled workforce. The enrollment is now over 2,000 students, and over 370 students received degrees in 2006. Research has been growing at nearly 20% per year, and has included work in support of both our largest companies, such as Intel and Tektronix, and some of our newest, such as Octavian, which is a small company being incubated on the PSU campus. These educated students and new and growing companies are the lifeblood of a healthy technology sector in our economy, and they're a key source of high-wage employment. The successes being achieved by the Massey College are due in large measure to investments made through ETIC. ETIC investments at PSU have made possible the hiring of key new teaching and research professors, expanded research, created valuable intellectual property, has improved the quality of undergraduate and graduate education, and has allowed the number of students completing engineering degrees to nearly double. However, the impact of ETIC extends well beyond PSU to the other Oregon State institutions of higher learning. Since its initiation in 1997, ETIC has increased engineering graduates statewide by 39% to over 1,600 per year, has increased federally funded research by 68% to over $54 million per year, and has seeded key research centers such as ONAMI. Data from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department indicates that technology jobs pay approximately twice the Oregon average. All Oregonians should have the opportunity to choose and successfully pursue engineering and applied science career opportunities if they choose, and ETIC actively supports this goal. Senior executives from Oregon companies partner closely with the Oregon University System and its universities to set priorities for ETIC for engineering investment, to closely monitor the progress of these programs, and to share publicly the metrics on progress and impact. Not only do these executives and their companies invest time in this process, to date, industry has matched the investment of each dollar from the state of Oregon with over $2 of investment from the private sector. Commitment, shared investment, accountability, and results. ETIC is, in fact, a great model for economic development. Oregon industry strongly supports this program and stands ready to continue their active involvement and financial support. ETIC has a great track record and high-impact plans. On behalf of the Massey College Advisory Board, I ask you to give particular consideration to supporting ETIC as you consider the path forward for workforce and economic development. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from our committee? Yes, Representative Bellin.
Yes, today we were going to look at Skill Up Oregon, and I think Skill Up Oregon is a wonderful, is a concept that we must embrace. But when I talked with Dick earlier, I'm going to ask, new technology jobs created as a result of the companies that have spun out of ETIC. Do you have any idea, Dick, how many?
You know, on a retrospective basis, I think it would be probably hard for me to estimate that. Perhaps the most relevant number that I have readily available is that the Oregon Employment Department is currently estimating that we'll need of the order of 23,000 new graduates in these fields between now and 2014. So I think, from an employment standpoint, for professional employment, one of the key questions in my mind as a technology professional is whether those will be Oregonians or whether we will be forced to import those skilled professionals and whether those high wage jobs will go to our citizens or whether we'll be bringing in new Oregonians to take them.
Here comes the politics, Chair Witt. As we looked at Skill Up Oregon, we had a dedication to the community colleges, but I must say, as we look at Skill Up Oregon, can this organization continue to produce the number of graduates it has under the current budget allocation for the university system in the co-chair's budget?
That's of course, always a key question. And I think what we have seen is a very successful 10-year collaboration between the state, the private sector, and the universities to focus very strongly on building the education programs and the research infrastructure that we need to have a healthy high-tech sector. It's no secret, I think, that the high-tech sector in Oregon has always operated under the handicap of not having as strong an education system and as strong a local research base as we would need. I think currently, perhaps I should review the budget situation. Industry had represented an increase this biennium of $34 million in investment into this program, which they were willing to participate in on a shared financial basis, matching some of these dollars through supportive programs. In the governor's recommended budget, that was reduced to a $17 million increase. The co-chair's budget, and the reason for my concern and appearance today, reduced that to $7 million. At $7 million, I think a lot of the innovative plans and momentum that we have created will very possibly be dissipated, and our 10-year history of building and making headway on this infrastructure will lose the dynamism that it currently has. For example, that gap between the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget would easily put at risk $16 million or more of private investment. It would also put at risk over $26 million per biennium in research contracts. I'm unable to estimate the other more intangible benefits because those research contracts will result in valuable intellectual property. They'll result in companies that are spun off. And that additional infrastructure will attract companies to Oregon to bring jobs and bring opportunities. So I think what we're dealing with here is certainly nothing that's in competition or conflict with the existing Skill Up bill. But I bring it to your attention because this may currently only be being looked at as a higher education issue, but in reality, ETIC is, I think, one of our most successful workforce and economic development initiatives, and I think it both needs and deserves support both from committees interested in education and those interested in employment, workforce, and economic development.
Thank you very much, and if I might, for the committee, I had hoped that we would hear from the community colleges first, and at the risk of bringing politics into this building, I'm very concerned about the community college budget as well. On this committee, and when they come, I will ask the same questions, and I think we're going to get basically the same answer, that our job as a committee is to skill up Oregon. That plan is profound in what it's trying to do. But I think if we're going to ask the community colleges and the universities to participate, then we can't ask them to do it on a funding level that is less than they've enjoyed in the past. Pardon me, Chair Witt, I advised you that I would be making a political statement.
Please.
There it is. Thank you very much, Dick. The correlation was brought to me by the university, and it's so clear to me, and I wanted to share that information with you. Thank you very much.
Representative Dolan, it may be appropriate if you wanted to draft a letter that could be available for each of the members of this committee to choose if they so want to sign, outlining to the members of Ways and Means just what is at stake should the Skill Up not be funded. I think the very possibility, just possibility, of losing $26 million in contracts because we are penny wise and pound foolish is something that we need to inform our colleagues of here as soon as possible.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I will take advantage of that opportunity.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, while we're talking about politics, I guess, I would like to mention that the Skill Up bill was predicated on a corporate minimum tax, which was agreed to in writing by the leadership from both sides of the aisle, which still has not come to a vote. So we're anxiously awaiting for that to happen so that we potentially could fund Skill Up Oregon. Thank you.
The trouble with introducing politics is it never stops.
That letter may have wider circulation before we're done. Anything else to questions or comments here from our committee? Dick, thank you very, very much for bringing this impact to our attention.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
I know we had a number of members from the audience who left. I also had a note from someone who did because we're not going to be working the bill. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify today on 2206? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. Ellen, could you please give us a brief review of what we're going to be doing on Wednesday?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, on Wednesday, April 11th at 8 a.m. here in Hearing Room C, you all will be having your first public hearing on three bills, House Bill 3252, which requires the Department of Human Services to publish and submit to the Legislative Assembly an annual report containing a list of employers with employees who receive public assistance, including food stamp benefits. There are amendments pending to that bill. House Joint Memorial 12, which urges Congress to allow the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to enter into 15-year contracts for biomass removal from federal forests. And House Bill 3418, which establishes an Oregon Main Street program in the State Parks and Recreation Department to encourage the preservation of and historic character of commercial neighborhoods. And then finally, we'll be having a work session on House Bill 2472, which creates a task force on extending the Washington County commuter rail to Salem, and there are no amendments to that bill.
Yes, Representative Holby.
Chair Witt, just a point of information or clarification. Will we also be considering House Bill 2206, which is being carried over on Wednesday?
Representative Holby, I am absolutely paranoid of scheduling that bill. Every time I do, the amendments don't show up. As soon as I have a reason to believe that amendments will be ready for that bill, I will. I and Ellen will get together and schedule that. So, just as soon as possible, I'm very anxious to get that bill up and out of here. We continue to wait and stay tuned for further developments. Anything else before the committee? Not seeing anything, we stand adjourned until Wednesday. Thank you all very, very much.